Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the former editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. I am no longer in charge of the editorial ship, but I'm still steering the audio portion of the ship. We record it from the Book and Film Globe radio tower atop Book and Film Globe Mountain, and that's where I sit now. We're going to talk this week to contributor Jillian Garr about Michael, the new Michael Jackson biopic made pretty much directed by Antoine Fuqua, but pretty much made by the Jackson family. It's starring Jafar Jackson, Michael Jackson's nephew. Features a lot of good music and a CGI generated chimpanzee. It's pretty thin, but if you're a Michael Jackson fan, I guess you won't be disappointed with it. But you probably will be disappointed in The Devil Wears Prada 2, which is the sequel to, you guessed it, The Devil Wears Prada. It's been 20 years since we've heard from those characters, and Stephen Garrett and I get appropriately bitchy about the world of fashion and fashion movies. He'll be along in a bit to talk with me about that. We're also going to talk about The Christophers, which is a new dramedy about the British art world with a fabulous performance by Ian McKellen, and I would say a less than fabulous performance from Michaela Cole, but your mileage may vary on that. And Stephen and I will talk about both those movies in a bit. And first, Jillian Garr will be here to talk to me about Michael.
Just have all these songs in my head. Just gotta get them out. Just getting started. I said you wanna be
starting something. There's no one like you. Got to be
starting something. This is what I was put on earth to do. And mother always told me. I knew you were different the moment you were born. You let your light shine into the world.
This right now is a Michael Jackson biopic called Michael. Very creatively, not the King of Pop or something else. Just Michael, and it has been widely reviled by critics and received very enthusiastically by audiences. The gap is there. And the critic for Book and Film Globe who wrote up Michael is Jillian Garr. And she joins me on the podcast for the first time since it's been rebooted. Hello.
Woo, nice to be back.
Yeah, good to have you. So, all right. So I saw this movie last night. And I mean, the audience I was with was, singing along.
Really?
They loved it. They loved it. They were tapping their feet. I mean, I thought the music sounded good, right? The concert scenes were decent enough. It's not really much of a movie, though, is it?
No. I mean, aside from the other controversy, that was the one thing that most surprised me. Kind of like what I wrote for, I guess it's the sister site, Rock and Roll Globe. I did the Amy Winehouse biopic for them when that came out a couple of years ago, Back to Black, I think it's called. And I remember the opening sentence was, the one thing I didn't expect to feel at an Amy Winehouse biopic was bored. And that's actually the way I felt with Michael as well. There just wasn't enough there. I said this in my review where people are praising Jafar Jackson's performance. What a good actor he is. He deserves an Oscar. These are the fans saying that. And I thought, you can't tell really how good an actor he may or may not be because they didn't really give him much to do.
Yeah, he's not really acting as much as he is impersonating Michael Jackson. And in that sense, I think he does a pretty good job. And I will say, I also reviewed the Amy Winehouse. I reviewed the Amy Winehouse biopic for Book and Film Globe. And the one sort of redeeming grace of that film was that Marissa Abella played Amy, and she was phenomenal, I thought, as Amy Winehouse. I thought she really channeled. I just love that actress. Jafar Jackson, you can't really say, you're right, like you said, you can't really say whether or not he's an actor. He just kind of, he does Michael's voice, and he looks a lot like Michael Jackson, so that helps. In that sense, it was believable, right?
Yeah. One thing I read, I actually just read this today, a comment where someone said, there's no insight into what made Michael Jackson tick. And I thought, bingo, that's it. You really don't have any insight. And the way the story was just so weirdly streamlined. Like, you know, it was from the success of the Jackson 5 to the success of his solo career. And they kind of leave out the difficulties. I mean, it wasn't that easy. Even the making of Thriller, you know, they finished the album. And then he and producer Quincy Jones decide they don't like it. And they spend the next couple of months remixing the entire thing. I mean, I think the filmmakers overlooked the real drama that was going on in his life.
Well, I mean, they overlooked, I mean, this is the contract. I mean, there's going to be a second movie, but I can't imagine they're going, you know, given that this was such a hagiography, I can't imagine that they're going to address the elephant in the room, right? You know, the sex abuse allegations against Michael Jackson. I mean, this movie makes him out to be an American hero.
Yeah, it's funny you use the word hagiography. I had that in my review saying if you, you know, looked up how many reviews use that word and if you played a drinking game around that, yeah, you know, you'd get pretty wasted very soon.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Stephen Garrett, I was our chief film critic, I was texting with him last night about it. And he called it Project Hail Michael. Deeply clever. All right. Well, look. But that said, okay. I thought that some of the concert scenes, I particularly liked the sort of nostalgic vibe of the early Jackson 5 scenes. And also, you know, while I agree that Michael Jackson's motivations and his creative genius weren't particularly well explored, you know, he did have some daddy issues. And I was pretty persuaded and taken in by Coleman Domingo as the patriarch of the Jackson family. You know, I didn't even sort of realize it was Coleman Domingo until very late in the movie. I thought his performance was pretty, he played it well. He's an excellent actor and I thought it was pretty immersive.
Yeah. I mean, even there, I thought they just kind of touched the tip of the iceberg of how awful the real Joseph Jackson was. Of course, they lump everything negative onto him and his character. And the real Joseph died in 2018. So, you know, no complaints from him.
The sense that Michael Jackson is like some sort of immaculately conceived music Jesus who just wants to stare out the window and read Peter Pan comics and doesn't, you know, and only becomes who he is to make his brothers and his mother happy.
Well, not even, you know, I would say not the brothers so much. There was something else kind of missing when, there was kind of resentment at the increasing focus Michael got as he was rightly perceived as the star of the Jackson 5. Then he goes on and has a solo career that just completely outstrips anything his brothers do. There was resentment on that. They do, and I think it was a lot harder for him to break away and be a solo artist than the film conveys. You do get when they talk about the Victory Tour, which Michael didn't want to do. This was in the wake of Thriller, and the brothers want to go out and do another big tour, knowing that with Michael there, they're guaranteed a good payday. And Michael was really resistant to that. He finally gave in due to his mother's pleadings with him to do this for the family. And I was revisiting that in before writing the review, and you know it ended up being tensions arose during that tour. Michael began traveling on his own. He had his own private jet and would stay at a different hotel from his brothers. By the end of the tour, the brothers aren't speaking to each other at all. It was kind of a hothouse situation.
And you know, here's the thing, Jillian. Right, you could do all of that in a good screenplay and still have the flashy music scenes. You know, there's no reason. And in fact, it would make the scenes even better, right?
Yeah.
Because there's dramatic tension underlying them instead of just, you know, Michael wants to be a genius. You know, Michael needs to be free. I don't think we can really talk about this movie though without mentioning the true star of the film, the CGI chimpanzee.
Who looked kind of creepy, I thought. Jeez.
Creepy, yeah.
I was thinking, as that technology improves in 10 or 20 years, people will look back at at that and say, oh, it looks so cheesy, the way we look back at effects in silent movies now.
I guess. I don't know. All I know is that when Bubbles emerged from the truck and wearing his diaper, I just screamed with laughter. And the people around me didn't understand why I thought it was so funny. My favorite scene in the movie, though, is the one where Bubbles just plays Twister by himself in Michael's bedroom.
Oh, yeah.
Like, well, yeah. You leave everything else out, but you put a chimpanzee playing Twister. You leave that in the movie. So, all right, look, I mean, but the thing is, like, this is one of those pop culture things where it's like, whatever people of discernment think or say about it doesn't really matter, right?
Apparently not.
Because it's a huge hit. Huge.
Well, I don't know if you've been following the articles written about this, and but I have since the film came out. I don't mean just kind of reviews, more sort of maybe you call them little essays or something, or observations. Yeah. Where, they make that very same note that despite the controversies hanging over the film, as you say, the elephant that's not mentioned that people know about, but the majority of the fans just do not care.
Yeah, they just want to hear the music, you know, at the end of the day. You know, they want to hear the music and see the dance moves. And, you know, all of our outrage, it's just pointless.
Well, I kind of drew a parallel. Well, I'm doing it now. It wasn't in my piece, but it reminded me of Bohemian Rhapsody, the film I'm talking about. Where some years before then, I had seen Queen's musical, We Will Rock You, which is set in the future and, you know, Queen song, save the world type of thing. And that got terrible reviews when it opened as a stage show, but it was a huge, phenomenal hit and ran for years. And on seeing that, and yeah, I enjoyed it. You hear the song and you stomp along and all that. And so when it was announced Queen was going to do this biopic, I kind of knew the path they were going to tread. They were going to go for something family friendly, feel good ending, hear the songs, and that'll be that. Without digging into more of the nitty gritty side. They also made up some quite fantastic scenes in that, which I never understand why they do that. I understand condensing a person's story, but when you make up things that did not happen, that always dismays me. And so I felt the Michael film was going to do pretty much the same thing. Let's say there weren't any of these child abuse allegations at all. Let's say that didn't exist. I think they would still take that same approach, you know, smooth off the rough edges, the feel-good story with the happy ending and, you know, the songs that you can stomp along to.
As one of Michael Jackson's hits that wasn't covered in the movie goes, it's pretty black and white. Right. I was waiting for Paul McCartney to appear in the film, and he never did. And there's no We Are the... That's the thing, is actually the best Michael Jackson, just like the best Elvis movie ever made was the Baz Luhrmann epic thing that came out earlier this year, which I just loved, the Elvis documentary. I thought that the best Michael Jackson movie ever made was the We Are the World documentary that came out on Netflix last year. That captured his mystique, to my Michael Jackson's mystique, to my mind, way better than this film does. That said, there is a chimp wearing a diaper playing Twister.
And you're probably not going to see that in any other film this year.
Yeah, and so you know, I just try to take away something from every movie, and that's my moment right there.
Well, I'm curious. So what time was your screening?
7 p.m.
And how many people were in the theater?
Oh, well, you know, and it was a Tuesday night. I don't know, 40. 40. You know, two of them under 10 years old, which I thought was kind of weird, but you know. And those kids did not like the scene where Joseph Jackson was beating little Michael with a belt, let me tell you.
Yeah.
but other than that, and there's the scene where Michael Jackson's hair catches on fire. That was kind of disturbing. Other than that, there's not much in the movie that's going to really bother a kid, though.
Yeah.
And there's a chimp playing Twister. And there's a giraffe. There's a lot of giraffe scenes.
See, I try and go to earlier shows to avoid the crowd. So I saw it on a Thursday at 4:30, and there were only six of us in the audience.
Oh, all right. That's like a private screening.
Yeah, it pretty much was. This was the day before opening.
expecting some sort of revelation about the evils of one of our greatest pop stars. But if you want to see the Beat It dance one more time, it's all there. The Billie Jean dance. I'm sorry, Motown 25th anniversary scene. If you want to just see it recreated, it's in there.
I was wondering why, after seeing the movie, excuse me, I know probably the first thing everyone will do when they get home is to look up these clips. And it did cross my mind, why didn't they just put together a big documentary with all these key moments?
Like Baz Luhrmann did with Elvis. it's Anton Fuqua's epic, the Michael, I don't know. We'll figure it out. We'll get it done. Jillian, Gar, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Let's talk soon.
Okay, yes, let's talk soon.
Nice to have your job. Got to go to Paris Fashion Week. For a bunch of pieces from the Chanel collection that year.
You still have all of it?
No, I gave it away.
What?
Would have been a bit much for a newsroom.
This is you.
Oh!
Who gives away Chanel?
It is.
Oh, dear. It's my favorite caftan. Oh. It's from my Andre Leon Talley collection.
It is awful. It is absolutely.
How dare it you? Is, you have no sense it is, of my style.
It is dreadful. It is absolutely dreadful. I cannot believe you wore that to record with me today. Stephen Garrett is here, and we're talking, if you haven't already guessed by my lame fashion jokes, about The Devil Wears Prada 2, a sequel 20 years in the making. Although, after having watched it, it feels like they could have made it in about, they probably made it in about 3 weeks. Not exactly.
Fast fashion. Are you calling it fast fashion? Is that what we're watching?
It seems like a very fast fashion to me. So it is a sequel to The Devil Wears Prada, which was a huge hit 20 years ago. And it has the same four main characters as The Devil Wears Prada. It has Anne Hathaway playing Andy Sachs, earnest intellectual, who is happens to be the most beautiful woman in the world. and of course, Meryl Streep in her iconic role as Miranda Priestly, sort of an Anna Wintour type editor of Runway magazine. And then Stanley Tucci plays her gay or very metrosexual assistant, Nigel, an Italian man with a British name. And then Emily Blunt plays Emily, the role that gave her name.
That's true. She had no name before that role.
Her name was just Blunt. Blunt. She didn't have a first name. All right.
And then everybody just started calling her Emily after that movie. That's right. I remember that. It was very weird.
But it's the way it goes. So in the first movie, Emily was an assistant, Miranda Priestly's assistant. And in this movie, she essentially works for Dior in the marketing department, but also seems to be dating some Jeff Bezos-like figure. I don't know. Look, all right. That's The Devil Wears Prada and 2. And
other stuff happens.
Yeah,
it's not just that.
Yeah, there's like,
I love how you focus on who Emily Blunt is dating, and that's the movie to you.
I mean, I was paying attention to that part because I actually thought that character was kind of funny.
I thought it was kind of funny.
And that character was kind of he had funny mannerisms, and there's a whole monologue about him shaving his chest, and I thought that was pretty amusing. That was actually,
but also he was like in on the joke, and he thought it was just as funny. He had that kind of like, I don't care, I'm crazy rich.
Yeah.
So you can laugh at me. I can buy you. I can buy and sell you.
Yeah.
Before lunch.
Yeah.
It was before my smoothie.
He was my favorite character in the movie. So The Devil Wears Prada. The original Devil Wears Prada, right? The idea is that Andy is a Northwestern, like me, a Northwestern University journalism school graduate who has lots of earnest ideas, and she goes to work for a magazine that is essentially Vogue. Runway is Vogue, and learns. I don't know exactly what she learned. She learns how to look good and be.
No, you know what? Okay. It sounds like you weren't a fan of the original.
I know. I love the original. It's a great. It's a great movie.
I think why it's a great movie is it's about that first job you have, or the first serious job you have after college, where it really shapes you up. You know, like there's a monologue where she goes, she goes pouting to Nigel, and Nigel's like, why do I care? Why do I care? He's like, so quit. If you don't like this job, quit. If you want this job, then do the job, you know? And I think that is such a great sort of slap in the face attitude, which is a very sobering and inspirational kind of attitude. Like, if you want to be excellent, be excellent. It takes a lot of work, and suck it up and stop complaining and whining, you know? And I think that the movie is not just like this, you know, kind of ugly duckling type story. It's very much like, this is what it takes to work at a very high level among other people who are working at a very high level. And so to a certain extent, it's the work-life balance, it's the sacrifices you make, but it's also the really kind of exciting prospect of working at your best and being around other people who appreciate and care about working at their best as well, you know, which I think is really great, you know.
Journalism at the height of high fashion journalism, right? Like, you know, Vogue,
right?
You know, Vogue and Condé Nast were maybe at their, not their 20 years ago, maybe not at their absolute peak, but pretty close to it. Whereas this movie, you know, there are no magazines essentially anymore. Journalism is collapsing.
Yeah.
Andy apparently left Runway to become, I don't know, she worked for ProPublica. Some, you know, she like does a four-part series on the Federal Reserve, and you know, has won all these awards, and then but her newspaper shuts down.
Right. Well, I mean, this is the interesting thing. So the first movie is very much like Andy Sachs' story, right? Like, it is her story and her journey and her evolution. And the sequel is really not about her at all. It's about the actual industry of magazines and fashion and where it is 20 years later. I mean, this is not a sequel anybody wanted or asked for or even was expecting.
Yeah.
And so whenever that happens, like with Top Gun Maverick, which did a much better job of giving you the sequel you didn't think you wanted or cared about, to a movie that was decades before, you know what I mean? But in this case, I think it is because they found a really interesting hook that could have been really good if maybe they had had a little bit more discipline. And I think they just got all excited about getting the four principals together. And that's really the best reason to go see the movie, because these are four great actors who were relishing playing these really distinct roles.
Yeah, and they're all
kind of defined them.
And they're also, you know? And they're all super watchable. But I would say that the story is very flat. It's the same beat over and over again. You know, Andy walks around wearing these incredibly gorgeous clothes and has a little problem to solve. So she makes a phone call.
She also runs down the street in a panic multiple times, like she did in the original. And they found
sometimes while making a phone call.
Sometimes, yeah. More often than not. There are a lot of iPhones in this movie. There's a lot of catch up with the modern day as compared with 20 years ago.
Making a phone call, Stanley Tucci is making a phone call. Sometimes they're calling each other. And you know, the thing is, like, there aren't any other real characters in the movie. Like, there, Andy has a love interest played by the Australian sitcom actor Patrick Bramhall, who's a vast improvement over Adrian Grenier's character in the first, but they give him like four scenes and he never leaves his apartment.
Right. And Kenneth Branagh is like Miranda Priestley's new husband, who it does a lot with very little. That is a flat character, but since it's Kenneth Branagh, you actually seem to kind of find him charming and interesting more than he actually is written to be.
And Lucy Liu plays Mackenzie Bezos, essentially, but she doesn't have anything to do either. There are other people, you know, there's new assistants and there's all that, but they're not given anything to do.
What it could have been if it had really excelled is something that I think everybody's curious about, which is, you know, where are all those people you worked with 20 years ago and what are they doing now?
I know where they are. They're on Substack.
Okay, well, there you
all
go.
All of them.
No, but I mean, you know, that guy who keeps showing up, the kind of chubby guy with the Yankees cap who doesn't have a name but just has a Yankees cap and that's how you know him. And it's like the confidant of Andy. He doesn't have a name. He could have been writing for Substack. That would have at least given a little bit more dimension. But, you know, it's, I think in general, like, there is a curiosity to return to your work family 20 years after the fact and see kind of a where are they now, which I think is what is so the real hook in this movie, right? And unfortunately, like you're saying, they just didn't really follow through. They kind of were thinking, this is enough. This is all we have to do. They kind of phoned it in at a certain extent.
Play is very flat, very meh. The clothes are good, especially Anne Hathaway. When she wears a different sometimes she wears a different. I swear to God, like she's in a scene wearing an outfit. They cut away to another character, and they cut back to her, and she's wearing a different outfit. I swear to God, it really seems to me she changes clothes so often that I sometimes feel like she's like literally just all she does is sit there and change clothes.
Thing is, in the first movie, there are monologues where people are making like actually pretty valid points and justifying the importance of the fashion industry and how leaning more into the industry part of it than the fashion part of it and making a case for how it actually pervades most of our lives in ways we don't expect, you know? So people were kind of doing the homework and bringing the receipts and actually making the case that the subject of Devil Wears Prada is worth paying attention to. In this movie, they don't do that at all. They kind of let like, oh, you know, the complete implosion of the magazine industry and the fashion industry. Everybody knows that story. We can coast on that. We don't really need to justify it, or we don't need to flesh it out or make it feel realistic. It's just a shorthand for like disaster, and everybody knows this, and we don't have to explain it, which is unfortunate.
Literally, they're walking around Milan to Vogue by Madonna, and I was like, yeah. I was there with my wife. I was like, come on, Vogue.
Let your body move to the music.
I actually said that. Come on, Vogue, really? And then there's a lame Lady Gaga song, and they don't do anything with
That's
it.
That's pretty lame.
It's a
little lazy.
Not only is it lame, it's lame. Say, Steven.
Hey.
All right. Let's go from the world of fashion to the world of art, which gets a little play in a much more indie movie that is currently in theaters now. It's called The Christophers, and we seem to do this all the time. Like Steven Soderbergh, the least retired director in the history of film, is back with another movie, another one. He had two last year. And here he has like a kind of
Can't stop.
He can't stop. Yeah, he is a camera. And this film is about art and art restoration and art's legacy. I mean, it basically stars Ian McKellen as an elderly painter named Julian Sklar, whose work doesn't like resemble that of like Lucian Freud or the guy Damien Hirst, but he's kind of like he's a bad boy British artist who like doesn't like the establishment and holds sidewalk sales of his own art. And they show him appearing on a reality show called Art Fight, where he like just ridicules school children's art projects, which is kind of a funny concept.
And very British too, like totally British.
Yes, very much so. It's like Taskmaster, but all about art. Really a good concept that I wish they'd done a little bit more with. And you know, let's be clear, like Ian McKellen in this role is phenomenal. What a performance.
Hey, he's very good. Right. He's Ian McKellen.
I mean, sure, but even for Ian McKellen, this is a great performance. I mean, you really see the sort of pathos and the ego and the vulnerability of this man, and even though his body is failing and he hasn't made art in 20 years, there's still that spark of, you can see the spark of genius in his eyes.
There's a lot of colors in his palette.
Yeah, just such an incredible performance, I think.
Yeah.
Explicit and not sexually explicit, but like, you know, you really get a sense of him. Here's where the movie falls down for me. He plays opposite Michaela Cole, who, you know, is not, kind of a new actor for like a screen lead. I mean, she had a very, very well-regarded HBO show called I May Destroy You, and you know, it's clearly talented, but I just felt like, you know, this movie was advertised to me as a clash between two titans of British acting.
Well, yeah, I feel like that you were kind of sold a bill of goods. But I do think she is, I think she's very good in the role for what she does and what she needs.
No, I mean, I feel like she does a lot of just looking at him while he talks.
Well, but that's my point, actually. I think she is very much a blank slate, yeah. And she also, I think what I really like about this movie is that the story unfolds so carefully and selectively, and you realize the different emotional notes that come out based on plot points that slowly unfold. And there is a sort of backstory between the two of them, which is revealed, you know, carefully and slowly and later. And they're each character has their own agenda that you don't really know until the story kind of, you know, continues and unfolds, for lack of a better word. And Ian McKellen's, you forgot to talk about his failed, you know, his
children. I was going to get to that. So the plot, the plot basically involves like Ian McKellen's two children, very adult children. One of whom is played by the absolutely despicable James Corden.
But he plays despicable. I mean, these are despicable. Failed kids, right?
I can't freaking watch James Corden do anything. I guess he was okay in Into the Woods, but I really can't. I can't stand that person.
But you're supposed to not stand on this movie. So it was good casting.
I guess. Okay, you can make that case. But still, I was like, oh my god, I have to watch James Corden. And basically, these two kids have sold a bunch of unfinished paintings that McKellen did. Didn't finish of a gay lover he had. They sold it to a quote unquote tech bro, and somehow managed to spend £1 million in less than a year. And they're basically like enlisting Michaela Cole into their scheme to defraud their own father.
There are these unfinished paintings which have never been shown the light of day, and they want Michaela Cole to, what is it? Remind me again. Either finish them or. Like actually create
restore them, or just kind of finish them, or as the title of Michaela Cole's show went, she may destroy them. She may
No, but she's great at what do you call it, like she's great at
art restoration. Restoration, and
art fraud too. She can paint in different styles, and she can create
fake art. I just feel like for someone who's a master of art forgery, she has to have more than one expression.
The thing is, I like that she's poker-faced. No. I think it really works well because she has this ulterior motive and agenda. And I think she's also very, like, just stone-faced watching the absurdity of these entitled, you know, rich characters live their ridiculously dysfunctional lives.
You're being very generous.
I just picture her.
Very generous.
I am. Yeah. Maybe. You know. She's a blank slate that I'm kind of projecting onto. But I have to say too, it was one of those movies that I saw like at a festival, so I wasn't really expecting anything. I hadn't read any reviews about it, and you know, like you say, Soderbergh, I think it was like the third or fourth movie that he had made last year. So, you know, I was curious and didn't know what to expect, and I was really charmed and kind of moved by the story in a way that I wasn't expecting. So,
well, I saw it sitting next to my wife, and then on the other side of me was a guy with a bad cologne who kept cracking his knuckles, and like during every emotional moment, he would like exclaim like, "Oh no!" And then he was sitting next to his elderly mother, and he was explaining the plot. Why do I even leave the house? Why do I do it?
I don't know.
I will say this by comparison: The Devil Wears Prada. Two, my wife and I had a whole row to ourselves. The theater was not a good sign, but it was dead silent the whole time.
Wow. Ouch.
Yeah. Not great for a comedy. The Christophers, on the other hand, people were actually laughing at points because it is at least a dramedy, if not a comedy. So I will say
it's a smart movie. It's a great story, I think. It's a very well told and well acted story, at least by one actor in your estimation.
Amazingly acted by one actor, and I don't know. I just can't get on the Michaela Cole train. But who knows? Yeah. Maybe she'll surprise me or destroy me at some point. this has been the fashion and art edition of the Conversations with Steven
and Cinema.
All right, I'm gonna slip on my heels and stumble out into the night and maybe get a surprise phone call from somebody who gives me a job. I like Andy Sachs. I could use a call like that right now.
Fair enough.
All right, go put on your Yankees cap, man. Run on your Substack.
I'm gonna jump on Substack. Right. Yeah, we're forge the mart.
I will talk to you soon. All right. Thank you so much, Stephen Garrett. The Christophers is in some theaters now. The Devil Wears Prada 2 is in every theater now, as is Michael, the Michael Jackson biopic. And Jillian Gar was here to talk to me about that, and I thank her for appearing on the podcast. It's been a while. So I'm Neil Pollack. I am the former editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We bring you the best content on the internet about the worlds of books and film and streaming TV. And we put out this podcast a couple times a month. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed yourself. We'll see you at the movies, or I won't see you while you're watching TV, because then I'd be peering into your window. I don't do that. I don't live that way. But I thank you for listening, and I will talk to you soon.
Original production.